Historian Paul Sparrow's new book, Awakening the Spirit of America, FDR's War of Words with Charles Lindbergh and the Battle to Save Democracy, is a new work of history that brings Roosevelt, his allies, and his adversaries to life as he fought to transform America from an isolationist bystander into the world's first superpower. Franklin Roosevelt awoke at 2:50 a.m. on September 1st, 1939, to the news that Germany had invaded Poland, signaling the start of World War II. The situation was dire, and Roosevelt quickly found himself facing an unexpected adversary, Charles Lindbergh, wildly popular, who led an aggressive attack on FDR's policies. The book, Awakening the Spirit of America, shows how Roosevelt overcame the forces aligned against him in a war against fascism. Paul Sparrow is a former director of the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park, New York. And again, the name of the new book is Awakening the Spirit of America. And we welcome Paul Sparrow back to the roundtable. Paul, very nice to have you here. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you having me on. And, you know, it's an interesting time to be talking about presidential politics.
Well, it certainly is. What can you rip out of today's headlines that is applicable to what you were writing about in this book?
Well, the most obvious one is the fact that there was foreign interference. You know, when you look at the 1940 election, you know, Nazi Germany was very actively putting out false information and Nazi propaganda, using members of Congress that were secretly being funded by Nazi propagandists and sending the propaganda out using congressional franking privileges, you know, so they'd have the Capitol Hill return address. And the British were also putting false information out there, anti-German information, because obviously they, British wanted America to get in the war on their side, and the Germans wanted to keep America out of the war. And of course, at this point, you know, Hitler was bombing England mercilessly. And so you see some parallels between Putin and Ukraine and Hitler in England. And I think you see this isolationist movement, which was very powerful in the late 30s and early 1940s. And there's an isolationist movement today. Actually, you can trace it all the way back to sort of our founding, when the idea was that we didn't want anything to do with these foreign wars.
And even the phrase happy warrior.
Well, the phrase happy warrior is a great story because, you know, Franklin Roosevelt had run for vice president in 1920 on the Democratic ticket and lost. And then in 21, he got polio and sort of went into the wilderness and disappeared for several years. But Al Smith, who ran for president in 1924, wanted Roosevelt to work on his campaign and to do the nominating speech at the Democratic convention. So in that speech, which was the first public appearance that FDR had after getting polio, it was a high-pressure moment as he sort of tries to walk out to the stage, you know, with wearing leg braces. And he gets to the podium, and the crowd erupts, and he gives this real barn-burner speech endorsing Al Smith, and he calls him the happy warrior, which is sort of a quote from a Wadsworth poem. And what's interesting is that really the happy warrior describes Franklin Roosevelt much more than it describes Al Smith, who was you know, kind of a cranky, cantankerous old guy. So the happy warrior stuck to Al Smith for that campaign, but really it became FDR's description because he loved to campaign. He loved the political fight. He loved to get involved with people. I mean, when he became president, it was a very dark time in American history, but certainly in the 36 campaign and the 1940 campaign, you know, he really, he would make jokes and he would use his opponents as punching bags. And he said, you know, I love a good fight. And I think that that spirit, you're seeing it again now in the Democratic Party, sort of after being moribund for an extended period, suddenly you see these people like Vice President Harris and Governor Watts really enjoying being out there, having fun, and being this happy warrior. So, yeah, you can really trace that all the way back to 1924, 100 years ago.
Paul Sparrow's new book is Awakening the Spirit of America, FDR's War of Words with Charles Lindbergh and the Battle to Save Democracy. Give us a sense of how Lindbergh came on the scene of being such a thorn in the side of FDR.
Well, I think it was a surprise to everyone. You know, he became wildly famous for flying across the Atlantic solo in 1927, then became even more famous when his young son was kidnapped and murdered. He became the subject of, you know, tabloid obsession. He actually fled. He and his wife fled America and went to live in England and Europe for a number of years in the mid-1930s. But while he was there, the German government invited him to come and fly their planes and visit their aviation facilities because he was one of the world's great aviation experts. And he did that. He was very impressed with Germany, very impressed with their technology, their innovation, their dynamism. And he looked at England and France as sort of these decadent, decaying old empires. Now, he would report back to the military attaché at the American Embassy in Berlin every time he would go to one of these German air bases or fly one of these planes. So he provided really valuable information and was very well respected by the American military, particularly General Hap Arnold, who was the head of the U.S. Army Air Corps. But then, you know, after Kristallnacht and Hitler starts really persecuting the Jews, he and his wife moved back to the United States in early 1939. And then once Hitler invades Poland, just a week after the invasion, he comes out and he does this radio broadcast. He hasn't spoken to the press in 6 or 7 years. And he does this radio broadcast in which he says, we shouldn't get involved in this war. You know, there's no reason for us. We're protected by two oceans. And he starts criticizing the speech that Roosevelt had given just a few days earlier, basically saying, you know, yes, there are, the Neutrality Act means we must be neutral. However, that doesn't mean you shouldn't follow your own conscience. You don't have to be neutral if you believe that one side is right and one side is wrong. So that's what started it, just, you know, a few weeks after the invasion of Poland. And then, of course, it just escalated over the next several years, right up until Pearl Harbor put an end to it.
What kind of overtures were made initially by FDR and the White House to address this with Lindbergh, I assume directly?
That first speech I was telling you about, the military attaché who he had been working with in Berlin was now the chief of staff for General Marshall, you know, in the White House. And when they found out, when the Roosevelt White House found out that Lindbergh was going to give this speech, they sent this former military attaché to meet him at the hotel room to offer him position as Secretary of the Air Force if he would support Roosevelt's policies. And Lindbergh turned him down. They were very aware of the influence he was going to have if he came out in opposition to this. And so that sort of set the tone. And you know, later on in 1940, the Republicans wanted to run Lindbergh against Roosevelt, you know, because Roosevelt's seeking a third term was highly controversial. But Lindbergh didn't want to hold public office. He didn't want to have to deal with the press. He wanted to just be his old man and speak his own truth. And so he remained sort of independent until he became increasingly involved with what was known as the America First Committee, which were pro-German isolationist groups with people like Henry Ford and William Randolph Hearst and Colonel Robert McCormick and other isolationists, including a number in Congress, who were fighting against FDR's policies of trying to provide weapons and aid and materiel to Winston Churchill, who was in desperate straits.
You write of the German government providing secret funds to Lindbergh's Nazi followers. How did that take place?
Well, it was fascinating. There's this guy named George Viereck, who had been, he was a sort of very sophisticated man about town. He was a poet and a philosopher and had been a major spokesperson for Germany during World War One, also the same sort of mission of trying to convince America not to get involved in this war, and took on that same role. And they were feeding him money, and he would write the speeches, particularly for a number of, like, for Senator Lundin, who was a senator who was working very closely with Viereck. Viereck would write the speeches. Lundin would give the speeches on the floor of the Senate, which then immediately made them part of the congressional record. So they were, you know, public domain. And because they were congressional record, they could be published for free, and then they could use the franking privileges to mail them out to millions of people across the country. He sent out over 1 million postcards, anti-Roosevelt, you know, anti-British, pro-isolationist postcards right before the election. And so this was all sort of secret, but the British knew about it, and they leaked information to the FBI. The FBI found out about it. In the end, 22 members of Congress were directly indicted for this, but the cases never went forward for the members of Congress. But Viereck was convicted and sent to prison.
Speak a little bit about when, at what point, Roosevelt and his administration was able to feel like they had a strategy against this and something that was working in turning the tide.
So right after the German invasion of Poland, about 70% of Americans didn't want the U.S. to get involved in this war. And then over the next, 2 years, you see Roosevelt just consistently pushing back and convincing Americans that they have a moral responsibility, that the Germans are the bad guys, the British are the good guys. And you start to see that public opinion shifting. But what really happens is after he gets reelected in November of 1940, he has like a 1 month period where he gets this letter from Churchill, where Churchill basically says, look, we're broke. You know, you have to come to our aid here. Otherwise, after we have fought the war and given our blood and treasure, we would stand naked, stripped naked to the bone while America is defended against future war. And Roosevelt comes up first with this idea of lend-lease, which is that, as he said, if your neighbor's house is on fire and he wants to borrow your garden hose to put out the fire, you're not going to sell him the garden hose. You're going to give him the garden hose to put out the fire,
right?
Which was very typical of sort of Roosevelt's folksy visual metaphors. And then he says, America must be the great arsenal of democracy, which, of course, builds on America's most valuable asset, which is our industrial capacity, our industrial might. But it protects our precious asset of young soldiers' lives. And we're not going to send soldiers. We're going to send the weapons over there, and they're going to fight them. And then he comes up with this idea of the four freedoms, that why should we care about what happens in other countries? Well, because these basic freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, freedom from want, that these are things that everyone in the world deserves to have. And so he's laying both a practical path forward, we're going to be the arsenal of democracy, but he's also creating this moral imperative that is what he called the spirit of America, the soul of America, is that we were founded on the core concept of our willingness to fight for freedom, and that immigrants coming to this country, that everybody had an opportunity to succeed, and that he believed that democracy and that opportunity and that freedom should be something that everyone in the world can benefit from, which means we have to defeat fascism. And I think it was a powerful message. And I think, again, as the atrocities increased and as the brutality of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan became more and more obvious, more and more Americans sort of realized that it was inevitable. And then, of course, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, made the whole thing moot, because the next day, America First folded, Americans united behind Roosevelt and the idea of getting involved in this war. And then you saw the emergence of America as the great superpower.
I apologize if this comes off as a tangent, but I am curious about it. I remember when I learned about Lindbergh, we learned about him as a hero, and we learned about him as the pilot of the Spirit of St. Louis and what he accomplished and the adoration of the people. And of course, yes, the kidnapping that you mentioned before. But it wasn't until I was in college or after that I learned of this aspect of Charles Lindbergh. So did I miss a day of school, or was this something that was fairly common in our teaching at a certain point of history about Charles Lindbergh?
Well, history is a pendulum, as we all know. It swings back and forth. But I think you're exactly right. I had exactly the same experience when I first started learning about Roosevelt's foe in this mission to convince America to get involved in the war. I was sort of shocked that it was Charles Lindbergh. Originally, I hadn't planned on focusing on him so much. But when you actually do the chronology, it's amazing. It's like a ping pong match. Roosevelt gives a speech. Lindbergh gives a speech. Roosevelt says something. Lindbergh says something. Roosevelt has a rally. Lindbergh has a rally. And you really realize, oh, my goodness, this is almost unprecedented in American history. During this period, a lot of libraries that had, been named for Charles Lindbergh took his name off the library. Their books were pulled off the shelves. I mean, there was a real backlash against him during that war period. But then after the war, there was a real push in this country to forgive the isolationists, to ignore all the bad things that Americans were doing, and to get on with our lives. And in 1953, I think it was, General Eisenhower had become president. He reinstates Lindbergh's U.S. Army officer status, which Lindbergh had resigned from during the war. And, Lindbergh sort of goes through this redemption period. Now, he was also an incredibly brilliant man. He helped devise the techniques for pilots to use oxygen at high altitudes. He developed several devices that help with heart transfusions. He was an early eco warrior. You know, he went and lived in Hawaii and was a strong environmental activist. So he did a lot of things in the later part of his life that sort of helped people to forget what he had done during the war. And then the sort of shocking postscript to the whole thing is that, you know, his wife, Anne, then he had a number of children. It was somewhat of a rocky marriage. But in 2005, these women come forward in Germany saying that they were Lindbergh's secret children and that he had a total of 7 children from 3 women in Germany that he had kept secret until he died. And they were sworn to secrecy. And until their mother had died, they couldn't come forward. And they had DNA tests. And sure enough, he had 3 secret families in Germany that no one knew about. So he was a complicated man.
I'm interested in then how, in your reporting of the book and in your looking at the story, of the idea of the awakening the spirit of America, at what point that becomes solidified in our history?
Well, it's very interesting because, again, you need to have the context, which is that, you know, Roosevelt becomes president in March 1933, the worst period of the Great Depression. America is broken. There's a real question whether our democracy, our experiment will survive. 25% unemployment, homeless people everywhere, people losing their farms, their homes, businesses shutting. It was a terrible, terrible dark time in American history. And it went on for a number of years. It really isn't until the start of World War II that we finally get back to full employment. And so the American spirit had been broken. And then when they looked at Germany, which had this vibrant economy, which of course was being funded by stolen assets from countries they conquered and from the Jewish population. And they looked at Italy and they saw these dynamic economies. They're thinking, well, maybe totalitarianism is a better solution than democracy. Maybe, as Lindbergh's wife Anne Murrow wrote in her book, Wave of the Future, maybe totalitarianism is the future and democracy is the past. And so FDR always believed in the American system. He really did. Even in the darkest hours of the Great Depression, even the darkest hours of World War II, he never lost faith. He believed in the American people. He believed in the American system. He just felt like all I need to do is get them to wake up. You know, they're in this deep sleep that was caused by this terrible economic depression. And if we can get them to understand and embrace who we are as Americans, then we can move forward. And I think that's a real message for today, too, is you know, we have to have confidence in the American system. We can disagree on lots of things. There's always going to be political factions and partisanship. But ultimately, we have to say the American system is filled with problems, but still the best in the world. And we have to believe in it and believe in each other. And I think that was his message then. And I think it's a message that resonates today.
Paul Sparrow is a writer, historical consultant, and the former director of the FDR Presidential Library and Museum. His brand new book is Awakening the Spirit of America. It is published by Pegasus. Paul, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. I love your show, and thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Again, Paul Sparrow's new book is Awakening the Spirit of America. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.